So, hi everybody, welcome those of you in the class and those of you online. And as you can see, we're about to begin a new module of our Buddhist teachings called Presenting the Path. Now, before any teaching commences, of course, it's very important that we set a good motivation, take refuge, and generate the mind of enlightenment. So, after we've done those sort of prayers, we'll begin the actual teaching itself. And during the teaching, there are places where you can ask questions. There's a slide, we put it up, and there's your time to ask. I'll do my best to answer. And then we do a little meditation, and then the sort of class commences again. As we always do, now it's important that you are comfortable in your seat. So just move around until you are comfortable. It'll mean that your sort of feet are flat on the floor or the cushion. That your back is straight and that your shoulders are relaxed. And have your head sitting evenly upon your neck, and you can either close your eyes completely or shut them in such a way that a little bit of light still comes in. So when you've done all that, you just relax and let the body breathe itself. And as the body breathes itself, focus upon the movements that take place in the body, either at the abdomen or the upper chest. Acknowledge those movements and the feelings associated with them, while you continue to allow the body to breathe itself. So the purpose of this brief meditation is just to relax and to be focused. So while you're sitting comfortably in your seat, and while the body is breathing itself, imagine that in the space in front of you sits Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light, and he is sitting on a golden throne. The Buddha is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas and meditational deities, bodhisattvas, arhats, and protectors. And then imagine that you yourself are surrounded by all sentient beings, and everyone is facing the Buddha and his entourage. And overcome aversion toward people you don't have a good relationship with or feel unsafe around. Imagine them in front of you, your parents beside you, mother on the left, father on the right, family and friends are behind you, and strangers surround these groups of people. You recollect that everyone equally wishes to avoid suffering, equally wishes to be happy, and equally lacks genuine happiness. Then recollect that the causes of suffering can be eliminated and the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. Now, to dispel the causes of suffering and actualize genuine happiness, we have to abandon attachment to the fantasies of this life. abandon attachment to all of the pleasures of psychic existence. To abandon attachment to our own singular welfare. And finally, we have to abandon attachment in the belief that we live in an independent and objective reality. Now, all of these abandonments can be accomplished. So decide to abandon all of them for your own welfare and for the benefit of everyone else. To help us overcome those abandonments, let's take refuge in those who have abandoned those obstacles and accumulated the merit to become enlightened. Now join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And in response to this prayer of ours and the recitation of it three times, imagine that lights and nectars pour from the heart of each enlightened being over yourself and all beings surrounding it. And these lights and nectars remove obstacles and empower your potentials of method and wisdom. In response to that empowerment, you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to establish all beings in those four boundless, immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment to friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours, again, lights and nectar stream from the heart of each enlightened being. They pour over you and over all the people surrounding you. And they reveal these four immeasurable qualities effortlessly manifesting. And in recollecting the field of merit with faith and devotion, prepare yourself to purify the mind, to accumulate merit, and then to increase the merit. Now the Buddha and his companions reappear as a field of merit. And in response to their appearance, we say, reverently I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great and mighty. Now, to prevent our clinging to the merit of the purification, let's offer a mandala with the understanding that this will provide resources throughout countless lives, counteract greed and miserliness, and along with the clinging we have to our body and the environment. So imagine your body, speech, mind, virtues, the universe itself, everything is utterly transformed and reappears as a wonderful pure land where all beings can take teachings by you. To affirm this, join me in saying, This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with mount berry, four continents, sun and moon. I imagine this is the Buddha hill and on it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. This offering has been released, and the Buddha accepts it and smiles at us. And we look up and we meet the gaze of the Buddha. And under his gaze, we feel accepted and at ease. And then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. And then this emanation descends down to the level of your heart. And at the heart level, it begins to expand, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. And these now pour out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And you think, wow, I've accomplished the two purposes. I've brought myself to enlightenment, and I've helped everybody else attain the same state. And in response to that thought, you hear the mantra of the Buddha resounding throughout space. And you join in, saying, Tayatani Let's recite the mantra a few times under your breath. I think from the furthest reaches of space, the light rays which have enlightened all beings begin to withdraw, pulling in the energy of all these enlightened beings back into your heart. Then feel the chair beneath you. The fact that your feet are on the floor and your hands are in this comfortable position. In other words, feel embodied once again. Think that you have the whole path within you and you're willing and able to help all beings. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open and move your body in whichever way you'd like to become comfortable and present once again. So again, welcome to all of you to this new course. I'll just go briefly through the outline. So we've got basically this course is going to last for 10 weeks. We've got these eight classes just like this. Then we have a review class. And finally, there's a game that you can play. We'll play together just to sort of deepen our understanding of what we've been taught. Now, the topics over these 10 weeks will include a brief history of Buddhism, and that's what we'll be talking about primarily tonight. Next week, we're going to be looking at the story of the Buddha. But throughout the 8 weeks, we're really looking at the different stages of the path and the different meditations that we'll do in relationship to those stages. And today's topic, like I said, it's about this brief history. So we're going to look at the Dharma as it was sort of flourishing in India at the time of the Buddha, how it spread, in particular to Tibet, then Australia, and then a little bit about our centre. Now, to present the material, I've relied upon a lot of resources. These are some of them. So if I was to suggest you to read any of these, if you wanted to, probably the best two books about the spread of Buddha Dharma throughout India, Tibet, and then the world would be these two books, Indestructible Truth and Secrets of the Vajra World. These are they're fantastic, easy to read, and you get a really good way of understanding.
Sorry, is that secret or secrets of the Vajra?
The
secret.
Secret of the Vajra World. Okay, so let's begin with a sort of a slide called this one, the Early Buddhist Councils. So what this slide is starting off on the point of view that the Buddha, or this person called Shakyamuni Buddha, has already passed away. And in fact, he's been, simple language, like dead, passed away for about 100 years. And then 100 years after his passing, they have this huge council to start discussing the teachings and their understandings or misunderstandings about it and try and sort it all out. And this type of council happened quite a few times. So we'll just go through some of them and I'll tell you about a little bit about each one. Of course, these are the earliest dates. So the first one took 400 BCE. And we've got some more modern ones coming up later. So the one that took place around 400 is about 483. So about 500 of the Buddhist monks are called elders. So these elders, they have really deep insight into the nature of reality. These people are called arahats. So in other words, everyone there had realized the emptiness.
500 of
them. Yeah. And these arahats, so these are not bodhisattvas, they're arahats. Right? So they're sort of people, well, not very much like you and I, except they've become ordained. And in other words, as an arahat, they've achieved their own personal liberation. So they have no more disturbing emotions. And they have great powers of recollection. So they all sat around this council and they go around and say, okay, so what did you hear the Buddha say? And this person would have to say, this is what I heard. And then they turn around, everybody else, did you hear the same thing? And if they found differences, then they'd have to stop and sort of have a little chat and correct it. The primary course for a gathering was to recite and standardize the rules of conduct. So what happened after this, you know, this 100 year after the Buddha, you've got all these little groups of Buddhists all over the place, and they're all relying on different texts. Right? They're all coming up with different ideas of what these texts mean. So they finally come together to have a chat about this and sort of organize it all. That's what they did first of all. Then we have the next one, 383. So here we got 700 monks gather, and again they address disputed points of monastic discipline. So in other words, when these groups that all when they go off to their different places around India, they're all behaving quite differently, independent of what they understand. You know, so we've got to come back together again and sort it out. And so this happens like a number of different times.
Quality assurance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's sort of like that's right. But the sort of thing has stayed the same. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Then the next one, third council, about 250 BC, under the King Ashoka. So some of you might have heard of him. He was a great king in India. who was a great warrior, but then at one time he became so disillusioned with the amount of people that he killed, he became a complete pacifist and a Buddhist. So again, they pulled everybody together. Let's see, only about 1,000 monks this time. Again, to purify the different communities of corruption and false views. So as you probably notice, even in this world, there are times out there where you have established religions and over time they become corrupt. Well, the same thing happened with the Buddhist teachings.
Even once they've realized emptiness.
Well, those who have realized emptiness wouldn't be. But the other monks, So actually this first one was the very first one was the 500 arahats that later on was just have gathered together these communities. And you've got arahats and ordinary people. Then in the next one, in 1871 in Myanmar, which was now called Burma.
Myanmar,
thank you. Yeah, so three changes, isn't it? Myanmar. Yeah, so again, they had one there, 2,400 monks in the 1800s. And the purpose there was to recite all the teachings and inscribe all the teachings on 729 marble slabs in the Burmese script. So if you go to Burma, you could probably find those, they're still existent, and go, wow, there's all the teachings of the Buddha in marble. Then in 1954, not too long ago, 100 or 80 years ago, 2,500 monks from 8 countries attend. So its first objective was to affirm and preserve the Dharma and the rules of behavior. So recitation of all these scriptures took 2 years, and all the texts were really painstakingly examined. Then what they did was turn them all into the books. So some of you might know about the Pali Society. They've created all those books. We've got a few in here. If you go to a Pali Buddhist center, you'll see them, right? So that all came out of that. It was completely all translated to English, so wherever an English person was and wanted to study the teachings, you could have the original thing there and look through it. Ben?
Were these later councils only Theravada?
Yep, only Theravada. Okay. So that's about these early Buddhist councils. Now I want to talk about the sort of spread of the teachings of the Buddha. So here, some sort of map just to show you the way it goes. I've got two maps up here. I guess it doesn't tell you a great deal by just looking at it, but you can sort of see from India, it's gone all over the place. So what I found really interesting when I looked at this was in 324 BCE, so that's way back. The Greeks came up with a philosophy really, really similar to this. Not the emptiness part, but the three marks of existence. I say not the emptiness part. When I read this book, I thought, wow, I had no idea the Greeks came at this. Some of you might have heard this guy say, you cannot step into the same river twice. That's from way back then. So why can't you sleep in the same river twice?
It's not the same water. It's moved.
That's right. And the other thing is, you've changed. So the river has changed and you have changed. So even like putting one foot in, you've raised the next foot up, you've changed. And so is that river, and you put the next one, so you never step in the same river twice. You're not the same person, the river's not the same water. Mm-hmm. Now, what I found really interesting was this comes from a Greek philosopher called Pyrrho. And I got the book and put it in the library. I started wondering about Nagarjuna's Tetralama, like how you come to emptiness. So the Greeks have the same thing. And I'm looking at going, geez, where did it come from? Did it come from the Greeks or was it the Buddhists? Was it the Buddhists who introduced the Greeks or the Greeks to the Buddhists? I'm not sure. I don't know. But most of the credit is given to Nagarjuna, the Buddhists. Yeah, so what the Greeks didn't have was karma. So it had a look at us like, no, they don't have any presentation of the internal cause and effect. And what I also found interesting was that they didn't adopt Pyro's techniques. They didn't do the thing. They went another way. And so basically, so now our education, religion, a lot of it goes right back to the Greeks, doesn't it? Our thinking, it's rooted in Greek philosophy. So their philosophy came out to show that things existed independently. In other words, intrinsically. Yeah, objective, right? So I am here, the world is there. I'm an object in this world. They took, that was the, so went on, and then we got influenced by it. And we've basically held on to that. But in the 1800s, what was his name? The guy, Hume? Does he bring the Scottish, David Hume, the philosopher, right? So he starts looking into himself to see who am I and how do I exist? What he says, I never find myself when I look inside myself to find me. I never find that. Because all I find is like bundles and flashes of emotion, thought, stuff. So when I read that, I thought, that's the Buddhist presentation on the five aggregates. So he found that. Then in the 1900s, even after, I think this guy was still alive in 1960, a German philosopher, he discovered that the idea that we are like in the world, and then you find out that in the early 1900s, with modern physics, right? So there's a, well, there isn't, we can't, whatever does exist depends upon an observer or a system of measurement. So anyway, but it's interesting because none of this has really influenced us. Now, we've just held on to the old views that don't actually, well, they're not really correct. So that's on the Western side. On the other side of the East, they come up with this other idea. They looked at, they did just like David Hume. They looked and they did not find themselves in the world. And this still applies to us now. We could do the same thing and you won't find yourself. Yeah. And so they had this idea of like emptiness and interdependence, that anything that exists does so dependently, whereas in the West was everything exists independently. Complete opposite. But like I'm saying, since the 1800s, the West has sort of caught up, at least philosophically and analytically and so forth, but it hasn't been adopted by us. Right? It's basically, we don't, it's not taught to us that way.
This time,
oh, yeah, that's right. So this is,
that's where it all went wrong.
So they call it the axial age. So we might have come across this idea that find all the major religions of the world are sort of created, and they've got lots of very similar ideas, but different ideas too. Anyway, this, so in Greece, and some of you might have heard of this great story where the Greeks first met the Buddhist philosophers, and they called the Buddhists to go along and see the Greek. So the Greeks conquered large parts of India, and they established their rulers there. Right? So all these rulers are really interested in listening to the philosophers and the people running the place to talk to them. One of these kings was called King Menander. Have you heard of the story where they caused the Buddhist guy to have a chat with him? And then the guy, this is where they talk about the chariot, where he says to the king, so how did you come here? He says, by chariot. And then they sort of ask him, like, what is it? What is the chariot? But where is this chariot? And then, of course, he's talking about where is the chariot ultimately? And the king is thinking, well, the chariot's right over there. Look, what are you talking about? You know? So they have this great conversation, and then the king sort of gets it. that this chariot is actually empty of any intrinsic nature, but does exist dependently. It's right there. If I don't analyze, there's the chariot. If I do analyze, chariot disappears. So if you do come across this, or if you Google it, there's some really nice ways of presenting the story. Now, much better than what I've just done to you. And you sort of, you know, it's like, wow. At least that's what happens to me. Okay, so when is Buddhism really promoted in Tibet? It's like 640 AD. It's quite a long time after the Buddha's passing. Finally gets up there, coming up from India. And of course, the interesting thing is many other countries become Buddhist before Tibet. So if you've ever gone along to those teachings by His Holiness, yeah, they do the different recitations of the Heart Sutra. Tibet's always last because all the other countries got the Buddha Dharma before Tibet. Interesting, eh? Yeah, so a couple of things I'll say. Let's say, so in 220 BCE, now before the Common Era, it's introduced into Sri Lanka. In 68 AD, it becomes the official religion in China. In between 150 and 250 AD, Central Asian Buddhists arrive in Vietnam. 372, we find a Buddhist monk in Korea, and then 400s in Cambodia, Burma, Indonesia. 485, it arrives in Japan. Finally, in 640, it arrives in Tibet. Yeah. In 1880, Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott become the first Westerners to receive precepts.
Yeah.
And in 1912, the first monastery for Western Buddhists is built. 1912, not too long ago, is it?
Is that in Russia?
No. I'm not sure. But it's a Theravada monastery, of course. So here's another map. Again, I've just tried to show, you know, as you can see here, the major things that's being pointed out is what types of Buddhism went to these countries around the dates. So you can see here Tibet, which is the last country I said. So that's where the Vajrayana went and was kept and is still practiced today. And most of us practice a sort of a blend of the Mahayana Sutra path and the Mahayana Tantric path. Any questions about this? So again, this is quite brief what I'm doing. I'm just keeping an eye on the time to go, gosh, half an hour's already gone. You know, we're just there. I want to take it elsewhere now. So what I'll talk about now is what it was like, unless we have a question. It's good? Okay. So now I'll talk about how it was practiced in Tibet and what the different traditions, because we are part of one of those traditions. Okay, so the first tradition, they call it the Nyingma, but Nyingma means old school. In other words, basically the first school that got the first group of people that got these teachings and put them into practice. So when Buddhism made its way from India into Tibet, Tibet at that time was a country that really worshipped our nature spirits. You know, you've probably heard of these things that many other countries have done this. They look around nature itself and they say nature is sort of holy or has spirits inside it. So they think, oh, the mountain is a mountain spirit, is a tree spirit. Most native cultures come, you know, they're religion this way.
Is that the Bon?
Yes, this is the Bon religion. Yeah. Then the Buddha Dharma arrives in Tibet, and then the king decides, "Man, we've got to get this." The king invited people to come and create the Buddhist Dharma in Tibet. So what they asked for was one of the greatest scholars in India at the time. He came to Tibet with this translator, it's really difficult to establish it. So they call upon another fellow called Padmasambhava. And here are some of the different people. So it's about this time, 754 to 797, what's that, about 43 years? So over that time, the king of Tibet, called King Phasong Detsen, he invites these people, Shantarakshita, Padmasambhava, to come. Shantarakshita helps build the first monastery and has the first people ordained there. And this is where they invented the Tibetan script. At that time, they had no written language, but because these teachings are coming here, he said, look, we need, you know, can't just keep sharing it orally, we need to write it down. So that's what they did. They devised a whole new language just for the Dharma. So I find this interesting because at one time we had a translator here, a Tibetan. Geshe is a Tibetan. They're both speaking Tibetan. The translator could not understand what the teacher was saying. It was Dharma, because the teacher schooled in Dharma language, the translator schooled in ordinary Tibetan. Mm-hmm. Different languages.
Dialect.
Not just dialect, but the different languages. So this is the Dharma language and this is ordinary language. Mm-hmm. They also had a language for the courts. Different again. And then you've got different areas of Tibet where we're all speaking different dialects and things like that, right? So you can see, you know, like, what would be a good idea to sort of standardize it through having written texts.
Why did they do, not the manners, but why did they have their own Dharma language?
Because they had no language of its own, of their own at all. So, yeah, they weren't sure what to do. It's like, do we adopt the Sanskrit that's all pretty written? So what they would do is they'd get the teachings from India, which are all written in Sanskrit, bring them back up, and now translate them all over into Tibetan. But you always see in the texts from the Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. So that way you know this is authentic. This is not made up by somebody.
They also used to translate it back into Sanskrit, as if they missed.
Yeah, I've got to go backwards and forwards, for sure.
Where does the Pali fit in then?
Not here. Pali comes later on. But this is just like in Tibet. Right? So in Tibet, there's no Pali tradition.
My Sri Lankan friend is very proud that it was in Sri Lanka that they translated to Pali.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in this tradition, so this is one of the traditions. There's four major traditions. We'll go through each one. What I want to do is show you a little bit about the history of its origins, then what they rely upon for their teachings, and just give you a little glimpse of a teaching. Right? Just say this is just one of the ways they look at phenomena and discuss it. So the Nyingma school and its teachings, well, this is the first monastery that was built in Tibet, 775. These books all talk about the Nyingma school and its teachings. This big red one here, deep one, it's like the complete thing by Dzogchen Rinpoche. It's like a massive encyclopedia. This one here is much more suitable for us, a complete guide to the Buddhist path. It's quite straightforward and you can read it. These two other teachings by the Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama, of course, is not a Nyingma lead or anything like that, but he does hold lineages from the Nyingma. Now, one of these lineages is called the lineage of the Dzogchen teachings. Now, Dzogchen within the Nyingma is the highest teaching. And most, a lot of people in the West are familiar with these type of teachings, Dzogchen. Now, but it's not the only teaching. So they have teachings very similar to us, but some that are very different. So they have these two lineages. One is called Karma and one is called Terma. And the Karma teachings are really like our Sutra teachings. You know, it's just cause and effect. So Karma means cause and effect. So it's like our Lam Rim teachings, right? It's just cause and effect, cause and effect. But then they have this Terma teaching. And the Terma lineage or the Terma teachings are hidden. So what happened when Padmasambhava was in Tibet, he hid a lot of teachings. He thought, well, the world is not ready for these teachings now, so I'm going to hide them. He hid them in trees, mountains, cliffs, underwater, in the minds of people. People who weren't even born at that time. So what he gives them is he put it in there later on, after many rebirths, it's like out it comes. It's quite strange. But it's still going on today. Like, there are lamas who can take you out there, and like you're looking at a cliff, and you see a cliff, and they'll go up to them and they'll whack, and then something crack into the wall, and then there's a teaching hidden inside the cliff. This is still happening, and they're still being discovered. And it takes really, you know, the people who discover this have to be quite highly realized, of course, you know. If we went out there, we just see a cliff, we don't know where anything is. But imagine that, finding a teaching in a tree or a cliff. And what also happens is people come along and then, geez, that comes this amazing teaching. It's like, where did that come from? You know, you got so many hundred years ago, Padmasambhava did this thing, and out it comes. So these are all accepted as being legitimate teachings in this lineage. And now there are also this, what they call the three lineages. Now let's see what I've got about that. I do not know, which I've forgotten, I'm sorry. But we also have what they call the nine yanas. So a yana is what they call a vehicle or a way of making progress on the path. So what they did was took what we call the stages of the path, and that would be three vehicles. Small scope, middle scope, great scope. Teaching for each of those scopes. Then the tantras, the lower tantras, and then the higher tantras. So in the higher tantras, there's three, in the lower, there's three, and in the other one, there's three. It is quite a different way of presenting it, but you can make sense of it once you know our system. It's quite straightforward. Now, I think one of the greatest teachers of all, and he's seen as easily being equal to Lama Tsongkhapa. And when you look at all the great teachers of Tibet, there are three that are always, these are the big deal. Right? So one of them is Padmasambhava. The other is Amaratisha. And the third is Lama Tsongkhapa. They're seen as the three greatest teachers of all that have come out of Tibet. And one of the quotes that I like, I particularly love this quote by Padmasambhava. So he said, though the view should be as vast as the sky, keep your conduct as fine as barley flour. I wonder what that means.
Yeah, that's good. I don't know what that means.
Okay, so what he's done in this one sentence, so the view, right, that's emptiness. So the view, of course, is as wide as the sky. It has no boundaries. You know, it's like what they call space-like emptiness. When you have this realization, you're sitting there, everything has disappeared, including yourself. However, what has not disappeared is the knowledge of that. That's still there, even though you can't find yourself, you can't find the mind, you can't find the knowledge, anything like that. So it's not like you've gone out of existence. It's just that you see, God, all the things that I thought existed objectively don't. So that's the view, as vast as the sky. Right? But then this behavior has to be so careful, because emptiness also means dependent arising. So your behavior is dependent. All the stuff you experience is a dependency. So be really careful about how you think, act, and speak. Because having your actions of body, speech, and mind empty means cause and effect work and dependent arising work. You're going to experience consequences of your behavior. So here there's no, it's not like, oh, there's the view there and there's conduct there. It's not like that. View and conduct are together, as it always has been. No. So he's saying why he says this always is because there has been a predilection for people who think they understand it, or they may understand it conceptually, but then their behavior goes out the window. They think because everything's empty, nothing matters. It's the complete opposite. So this is why I said, don't ever think that because you've realized phenomena have no intrinsic existence, that you can do anything you like and there'll be no consequence. This is why I said, be really careful about your actions. So I say to my partner often, I say to her, why are you doing it? You know, if we're going to go here to see this person, that why? Just to keep it straight, right? You're going to go, we're not going there to harm them, are we? We're not going there to start an argument or something, right? Our purpose of going to see them is to attain enlightenment, isn't it? Which means you have to be very careful about how we speak and how we behave. So this is this conduct, as far as Bali flows. So you know that whenever you create an action, there's always an intention to create it. And that's the karma. So you've got to be really careful, just right there. That's the best place to be careful. Ask yourself, why am I doing this? Well, that's right. So, rules are dependent arisings. Right? So that means, you can't hold on to them as really being something really solid. It's like, if the situation changes, sometimes you have to change the rule.
Just Mandy commented the previous slide with the three lineages. She's asking the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana.
Maybe. I'll have a look, Mandy, but I think that might be it. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so let's do a very quick meditation just on this section, especially about this lineage here. But just get comfortable in your seat. Remember, meditation is just a way of familiarizing ourselves with what we know, what we understand. So just let your body settle and your breath find its natural rhythm. And imagine all the people that used to practice this ancient tradition called the Nyingma lineage are present and wishing to help us. And this teaching of the Nyingma offers some quite unique teachings. So what do you recollect of this tradition? So you might have recollected the great teacher Padmasambhava, or that the type of teachings there are called karma and terma. Perhaps you recollected the three lineages that Mandy just mentioned, or the nine yanas. Now, if you come across these teachings, what might attract you to them? What attracted me to these teachings are the teachings on the mind. The Dzogchen is all about the empty nature of the mind. And if you understand that all of your suffering and happiness come from the mind, you'll be interested in its nature. So remember that Padmasambhava said that his view was as wide as the sky, but his actions remained as fine as barley flour. What's the most important meaning that you can take from that quote? I would suggest the meaning might be, never think that emptiness means nothing. A view as wide as the sky means that all phenomena have no intrinsic nature, but do exist dependently. Cause and effect work. Consequences follow cause and effect, cause and condition. Now, if you find something useful in this school, take it away with you and use it. Use it to help yourself and others. And now, breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale. Now, a new school and the texts that came from it, which really support our tradition and others. So here I'm talking about the Kadam tradition. Now, so one of the things that happened in the history of Tibet, especially with this old tradition, the Nyingma tradition. Now, at that time, there are no monasteries, and the people mainly practicing it are lay people like us. They're living in their homes, and what they have is wandering teachers. They may be ordained, they may not be. And what they do is they come around, they come to your house, and you get a teaching from them. Or you might be wandering about and come across them and ask them for a teaching, and they give the teaching. Now, these people were also practicing the Sutra and Tantra. And what happened was a lot of misunderstandings arose. So then the vows got broken, and lots of problems arose in Tibet. So the king went, this is no good. We need to have a relook at what's going on here. So they invited a great teacher called Lama Ratisha from India, and he came to Tibet. Some of you might have read this, the background stories. It's an incredible story. So Lama Ratisha came then. The deal for him was he had to go back after 3 years to India. It was like he was the greatest scholar in India, and they still celebrate his birthday today. Right? Yeah. So he had a huge impact on India and Tibet. So he was to come back after 3 years, and he got stuck in Tibet because there was a war going on. He couldn't get back into Nepal and then go into India. So as a way of apologizing to his Indian masters, he wrote this text called A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment and sent that back. And that text has had an immense impact on every Buddhist school in Tibet ever since. All the lab rooms are based on this book called The Lamp for the Path. Heaps and heaps for every tradition. So this book, like I said, is called Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. It's only got 68 verses. And if you read it, I mean, we still have the text here, you can read it. They're very short. Author is Atisha Srinanda. It was published in Western Tibet at this monastery, which still exists, still there. And it's called the Tolling Temple. In the mid-11th century. Now, what was fantastic about this text was up to this time, there was no order for studying. Like, you know, like I said, it was like here in a way. When we didn't know about these Lam Rim texts, you'd go to a bookshop and you'd buy a book on Buddhism, right? And you'd read it, and you'd go somewhere else and buy another and another, and then over a little time you look at it and go, they're different, you know, and then okay, I like it sort of thing, but how do I practice it? So there's no clear way of learning how to practice this thing called Buddhism or the Dharma, yeah? This is the genius of Lama Ratisha. So he set out what they call the three practices for the three types of beings. That's, he said, look, if you're a beginner, practice like this. Do these practices. If you've never come across the Dharma and stuff, start here and do this. If you do, you will be assured of a happy rebirth come the time of your death. Then he said, but for those of you who actually want to go even further, they provide the this is what you do for the middle scope. You want to bring about your own personal liberation from cyclic existence, practice these things. There you go. And finally, if you wanted to become a Buddha, practice this. Practice the higher scope. So that had never been done before. When I got back to India, I was so amazed and pleased I could leave the teacher alone. You're fine, mate. This is worth more than you coming back here, right, this book. So I don't know about you guys, but I've had, you must have done, if you like to read, surely sometimes you've come across books that you just go, wow, like, man, that's, and like you remember lots of stuff from it. And you might even keep it and room to go back to it because it's terrific advice. In it. So for me, I had a book like that called Man's Search for Meaning. It was written by this guy who was at a concentration camp. And that turned my whole life around. I read that book, it was like mind-blowing. I started doing what it advised while I was in prison. And then I came out of it, my God, the same Buddhists are doing the same thing, what this guy has said. It's based on that. You know, your mind makes up your reality. Life doesn't have meaning in itself. We give life meaning. It's again, it's like this, what the Buddhists say. No, how do things exist? Through imputation, through just putting a name on it. It exists. And as soon as you do, an effect happens, doesn't it? It comes back at you. So that means like, be really careful about how you think, because whatever you think is going to have an impact on you pretty much immediately. And he also showed you that meaning was not intrinsic to the objects. You know, in other words, you look, we give the objects meaning. The meaning's not there. And that was my thing. I kept thinking life had no meaning, because I couldn't find any there. And that's why I ended up in jail. If it has no meaning, well, guess what? Do whatever you like. And of course, if you do, you see what happens to yourself, right? You get in a lot of trouble. So it's great for me to end up in jail and then to read that book. Because like I said, my thinking changed in there. It's fine. You know, imagine you make up your own meaning for being in jail. Mine was really simple. I want to discover how things exist, what's reality. That's the meaning I give to my time here. So by the time I came out, you know, I went through all the different religions except Buddhism, because there's no books about the Dharma in jail. Okay, when I come out, and then I thought, it doesn't matter really. It's like, is anybody doing it? Because if the ideas might be great, but if no one's doing it, like, can you even be certain it can be done? Yeah. I thought, well, there's got to be someone like the Dalai Lama who must be doing it. So I thought, okay, when I get out, if I ever get out, I'll go and see him and see if he's the real deal. And if he's the real deal, you'll have a lot of confidence in this thing. And that's how I ended up here, basically. Very similar ideas. It's all imputation. So this school, with a teacher, he didn't form the school. What happened was his best student, so a teacher was a monk, his best student was a lay person like us. And he passed all of his major teachings to the lay person, not to the ordained. And Drom Tompa, they started building a monastery for the Kadam. All these great teachings came out of it. What's terrific about the Kadam tradition is they're really down to earth. You know, like if you read some of the books in the Kadam tradition that we've got here, it's like sort of shocks you because they're really blunt. You know, they're not using fancy language either. They come straight to the point, and it's like that. And like I said, what I like it because it can shock you out of your own apathy, out of your own wrong ideas. So that's why I particularly like these guys. So some of you might remember a Kadampa master called Geshe Ben Ganjil. So like he's really famous, this fellow. So one time he was meditating in his cave and he knew that his benefactor was going to come up there to give him some food and, you know, make offerings to him. So he thought, oh God, my benefactor's coming. I better clean my cave up. So he starts cleaning up the place and makes a really nice offering and everything. And sits back and sort of really proud of himself. And he goes, oh my God, what have I just done? This is all about my own reputation. This is not Dharma. This is a worldly concern. So he grabbed the ashes from the fire and he threw them all over his altar. Right? And miles and miles away, another lama could see it. And just went, the best offering in all of Tibet today has been done by Geshe Ben Ganjil. Probably the other one you might have heard of is when he was wandering about, he came to a house, called out, nobody was there, so he went inside, and he was hungry. Yeah, and, you know, like just like us, really, if you're hungry, right, you just go for the food. So that's what he did, right? He's at this fellow's house, opens the sinks up, he puts his hand in, grabs the food out, and then he realized, oh my God, I'm stealing food. So he grabs his hand like this and runs out, goes, thief, I'm watching. Yeah, so I really like those stories. It makes it really direct, obvious to you, and he's a funny guy. He also, last story about him, also like this one. So he never practiced like anyone else. So, you know, everybody else is got their robes on and so forth, and he's there, they're all studying. So he goes in with his robes, he doesn't study. He doesn't read, he doesn't recite, he does none of it. And he's just sitting there at the table, and he's got his robe, he pulls his robe over his head and sits there. You know? And so people are getting a little bit upset about this, right? And kind of like, what the heck are you doing? And he says, well, he says, with the spear of my awareness, I wait for the afflictions. If they come at me, I come at them. But if they leave me alone, I relax. And that's all he used to do. I just watch my mind, watch the mind. The mind is the real thing. Not all this reading and studying and reciting and all these things. So I like that idea. Just like make it real simple and be direct about it. Don't, you know, fluff about. Of course, yeah, that suits him, suits me a bit. But of course, if that technique doesn't suit you, do something else. There are plenty of other techniques. So this is Kadam Linya. So these are some of the books we have in the library. And I've read all these. This is like, I like them. Kadam are great. So what we've got to say here. So they're really big on meditation and scholarly study. Big things for the guru devotion. Seven limbs that we did in that prayer of ours, and especially thought transformation. So because I'd read that book in jail, A Man's Search for Meaning, and understood about how everything is transformative just through your thought and your language, you know, and I practice that in jail all the time, make it really easy for myself. It's easy. Because I've done it, so it's when I read what these guys are doing, I was already familiar with it. So it's quite easy for me to take these ideas and run with it. You see, and this tradition is the child of what we've become. So we are what they call, we are the Galupa tradition. We come out of the Kadam tradition. The Kadam is the basis for our tradition. Lama Tsongkhapa based heaps of the stuff on the Kadam tradition. In fact, every other tradition we'll talk about did the same. This tradition is so respected, but it's vanished. It no longer exists as a separate tradition. It's been incorporated into every other major tradition of the Tibetans instead. Now, here's one of the things I think that Master Ben Ganjil said. It's probably that one. Here we go. I have no task other than to stand guard at the gate of the afflictions fortress, holding the spear of the antidotes. If the afflictions are vigilant, I remain vigilant. If they are relaxed, I remain relaxed. Yeah? So this is a really good advice for us, because I know that some students try really hard and they study and study and they burn themselves out, right? They just make it really difficult. So we all should learn to relax. Study, sure, but with a relaxed mind. Don't get uptight with too many expectations and push too hard. Okay, so now we'll come to the next lineage. So we've started off with the original, the old lineage called the Mingma. That out of that came this thing called the Kadam lineage, based on Nama Atisha. And from that come every other lineage. So the first one we'll talk about here is the Sakya lineage. And again, these amazing stories. But the lineage come about from a great teacher called Vairupa. So I should tell you a little story about him, because he's really funny too. It's great. So he was a great meditator and studying, and he had realizations. And he was in a monastery. So what happened one day was that people would walk, you know, so you're in a monastery, you've got your little cell and the doors are open, they're not closed, right? So people can walk past and look into your little cell. Right? And they did. And what they saw in there was Vairupa with different women and food and drink. Right? And they go, you just can't do that sort of stuff in the monastery, right? But this guy's really sort of high up in the monastery too. So they tell him, you have to go. You can't do this here. He's like, okay, I'll go. So then he goes down, so he goes into town. Where do you think he's going to go to?
The brothel?
The pub. Oh, yeah. I need a drink, right? So he goes down to the bar. And of course, he's got no money because he's a monk, right? So he goes up to the barman and the guy's looking. He says, look, this is what I'll do. Give me a drink and I'll keep drinking till the sun goes down. When the sun goes down, I pay you. He goes, that's beauty. I'll take that deal. So he starts pouring them drinks, right? So the sun doesn't go down. This guy keep, and this guy doesn't get drunk. He keeps drinking.
When are we talking here?
Whoa. Well,
around.
Between about the 8th to 10th century. Mm-hmm. The stories of Vairupa are like amazing, right? Because then you find out, like, wow, all those women and drinking that, people saw them, but they didn't actually exist there. He created them. And it was the same thing in the bar, right? They look out there, the sun has not moved. And so the barman goes, we got somebody really special here. His only has to tell him, like, please stop drinking, because you're going to drink my tavern dry. And I'm like, no, he goes, oh, sure. So he stops. Vairupa's got great, terrific stories about him.
Why did he do that, though? Like, what was his purpose?
Well, I don't know.
To get people's attention.
So yeah, well, they certainly got that. And it was the same thing in the... Yeah. So what's... You know, from my perspective, I thought it might be yours too. We often think that you go from a lay person into becoming ordained. That's the trajectory, right? And that is true up to a point. So once you become ordained, of course, you're introduced to all these teachings and you have to abide by them. But then, of course, then you're introduced to Tantra. And if you can get really good at Tantra, what Vairupa did, you could do, because that's what it comes from. It doesn't come out of sutra practice, it comes out of Tantra practice. However, if you practice Tantra like that in a monastery, you can't. You go, no, you can't have that behavior in a monastery. You have to become a lay person. And so they do. They keep heaps of vows. They've got to keep all their tantric vows, their bodhisattva vows. All that's there. They're just in different clothing.
He's just living his tantric life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, sounds like
anyway, there's a number of these people. Another great teacher, this guy called Kanga Ningpo, he was like, I don't know, 13 or 9, some very young age. He had a vision of Manjushri. And he created a text called Parting from the Four Attachments that I might have, which is a fantastic teaching, right? The Sakya Pandita. So he was the guy that brought the Dharma into, he was the go-to guy of the Chinese emperor. Another great story there. So why was it the Chinese accepted the Buddha Dharma? Why did they make China their official religion? Why did they make Buddhism the official religion of China? So what happened was the Chinese emperor said, look, I'll bring all these different religions into the court, and you explain to me how they work, what they mean, all that stuff. So Christians were there too. When they existed at the time, they were in China. So he's got them there, they all tell him about their religion. And he goes, I don't know what to do. Like, I can't decide on your philosophies. Can you show me some other way that these teachings are so valuable and strong and everything like this? So Sakya Pandita made a tray full of drinks, move through space, and come and sit down with the thing. No one else could do anything like that. The Chinese got said, right, Buddhism is going to be the religion of our country. And that's how it happened.
Party trick.
Yeah, well, that's right. But no one else could do one as good as that. it's strange stuff. That's the story. Now, the Sakya teachings are based around what they call the Lam Dre. The Lam Dre just means path and its fruit. But it's made up of two parts. It's made up of a teaching called the Three Visions and the Three Tantras. We have, again, both these texts in here. What makes, what I found makes Sakya teachings quite difficult to get your head around, and when you read them, even if they're in good written English, is where they're, how they present their material. So they present their material as if you you're not completely like an idiot. I mean, you're not completely ignorant. They present it as if you've already entered the path. You're not enlightened, but you have entered the path. And so they present like, this is what the world looks like from an enlightened perspective. This is what it looks like when you're unenlightened. So, and they're together, right? That's really difficult to hold these two ideas in mind as you go through it. But that's what makes it, I go, well, not for me. it's too difficult. However, it does, you've got great, great masters, like I said. The Sakya Trizin, this fellow here with the book here, and he's like, they say, just like His Holiness is a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, this guy's a manifestation of Manjushri. And so this is, so what this guy did, right? So this is like nowadays. He had a student that had one of those cameras that you take the picture, the Polaroid camera, right? Let me take a picture of you. Yeah, sure. So he sits there, the guy goes, click. He looks at the thing, nothing. There's the throne, but there's nobody on it. And he's going like, there's got to be wrong with this, right? Yeah. And he's laughing, right? Click again. Same thing. Then the fellow beside him says, like, give me a chance, right? Next picture, there he is. So when I saw him here, I went to see him, Sakya Trizin, right? It's the weirdest experience. Like with His Holiness, you get close to him, you can feel the warmth, the affection. You get affected emotionally by it. You get close to Sakya Trizin, it's like he ain't there. It's like you got nothing, there's no
substance.
Yeah, it's like empty. Like that's how it feels to me. And then it's like, wow, this is really weird. And I didn't want to say anything about it. I thought maybe there's something weird about me. See? But then about 3 years later, I met another guy who'd also met him. And then he told me he had the same experience. I was like, okay, I'm not that weird. Right? It's like, yeah, you get this. It's strange. Yeah. Here's the teaching by the Kanga Ningpo when he was 12 years old when this happened to him. So this just came into his mind. He's meditating and this is what arose in him. It says, if you cling to this life, you are not a practitioner of the Dharma. If you cling to the three realms, that's not renunciation. If you cling to self-interest, you're not a bodhisattva. And if grasping arises, it's not the view. So this is called parting from the four attachments. And I went to a teaching on this. It was, wow. All these people, I mean, this man was in his 80s, fragile as anything. You look into his eyes, the humility that was there. It just made me feel really creepy, like I was too big. And I started crying, and everyone was crying. All everywhere, just weeping. And this guy's, he's held, you know, because he's so old, and they put him up on this throne, and then he speaks, and it's like that man's a 30-year-old fellow inside that old body. The power that just came out. Trakin Rinpoche, he was the head of the Shakya lineage at that time. Again, if you ever get a chance to meet authentic teachers, go. Right? Big difference in listening to someone like myself or you know, normal Sangha members. These people are something different. So when he passed away, there's still stuff up on YouTube in Nepal. Now, he was the major teacher to the royal family of Nepal, of Bhutan. This guy was something else. And when he first came, he went to New South Wales. And so Miffy's mother, Inter, and I, and another student, we drove down there to take these teachings. I went there because one of the monks that I've met said, there's an eighth ground bodhisattva coming to Australia. And I went, what? And he said this. I thought, I'd never know who a Buddha is, you know. But if you tell me an eighth ground bodhisattva's coming here, I'm going to go and check them out. You know? So when I went, it's a mark of respect, you don't look in their face. So everybody's sitting there like this, their hands there like this, and then all the Tibetan horns are coming up, and you can sort of see the feet coming, you know. And I'm like, I've got to check them. I've got to look. So I looked up, we went, boom, looked up into his eyes, and he looked straight at me. Eh? And that's why we just said, started crying. I've never had an experience like that ever since. You know, that was like, wow. And then, of course, you know, the teaching, and everybody was crying. You know? And it was something.
Sorry, quick question. What's an eighth ground?
Oh, okay. So the eighth ground bodhisattva is like, so that level, especially there's no afflictions whatsoever. They've definitely realized emptiness, and they're at the same level as all the arahats, the people who've worked for themselves. So the eighth ground has got, you've got the eighth, ninth, and tenth ground to become a Buddha. And what they're trying to do there is remove the really subtle obscurations. So everything else has been done. I just thought, man, I knew what an eighth ground bodhisattva was. So I thought, well, I want to see what these guys look like, how they behave, you know. Okay. So then we've got the Kagyu lineage. Again, incredible stories about these masters, if you ever get a chance to read them. But it's all culminated, this lineage, in what they call the leader of the city, is now called the Karmapa. So you might have heard of this fellow. In fact, there's been a controversy a few years ago where there were two Karmapas. They had a bit of argy-bargy going forth, but that's all been resolved. Now, these guys, in terms of their teachings, they'll put up different texts that we have in the library here, and they're all about this. They rely upon a thing called the dual ornament. So that is just like Lama Tsongkhapa's lam rim. And it came out way before Lama Tsongkhapa's lam rim. It was one of the very first lam rims there was. Then they also relied upon a number of practices called the six yogas of Naropa. But their main thing, like in the Nyingma and Salt Chen, in these guys, is Mahamudra. So Mahamudra just means, Maha means great, and mudra is a seal. So it's saying like, so the great means like everything. And the seal is everything is sealed by emptiness. All the phenomena that exist are empty. And they're like that, right? The two truths are unified. And one of the great masters called Saraha, one of these great masters called Saraha, he used to say that the mind cannot be seen as being an external or internal reality. He who abandons thought and the object of thought dwells in the mind's natural state, singing the song of indestructibility. But Tilopa, who was his student, said this. I love this one too. Don't recall, don't imagine, don't think, don't examine, don't control, relax. That's one of the highest teachings you can get. Right? And it doesn't just mean, like I said, just don't think, you'll get it. And of course, there's lots of text written on this on the commentary.
Not saying being lazy.
No, and they're like, yeah, I'm not going to think about that. No. You know, we say that, that's not what it means. So it all looks quite simple. The instructions are simple, but the doing of it is not. Yeah, these are called Tilopa Six Snails. Now we come to our tradition, the Gurupa tradition. So in the past, it was formed with Lama Tsongkhapa and his two spiritual sons. We have a statue of them right over here. Today, we have what they call the 105th Gadin Tripa. So our lineage, this is the throne holders, not the Dalai Lama, it's the Gadin Tripa. And they change every so many years. If they pass away, another one comes. So I think this is the 105th. Yeah. So ever since this lineage has been created, there's been 105 different bosses of the lineage, so to speak. And the Galupa texts and teachings, what I've put up here are all the different lam rims. So in our lineage, so a lam rim means graduated instructions for achieving your goal. It's a bit like in our school system, we go to kindergarten first, then primary, then a little bit up, and finally we might go to college. So this is how the teachings are presented in our lineage. Quite simple to begin with, and then they become more and more involved and difficult. And there are eight different texts. We have all of them here in our library now. And in fact, of these Lam Rim texts, there are like 18 different ones, but eight major ones in the Galupa. And His Holiness, a few years ago now, gave commentary on all of these Lam Rims. And I said, oh man, I'd love to be there, or like have the text or something. I could, you know, hold myself and go through. And this, like I said, because the Galupa lineage, our lineage, is really based on the Kadampa lineage. And so what's really important is like guru devotion. These stages of the path and the thought transformation techniques. And finally culminating in Tantra. So that's how we sort of like study. But when it comes to practice, we try and integrate all of it. You'll see this again and again, isn't it? Like, there's all these elements of tantric stuff that we do here, but it's made in a sutra, but it's all mixed up together. So there's a real good reason for that too. And they describe this reason metaphorically. Like, suppose you were, you had a garden, you were trying to look after yourself, And so you had to grow your own vegetables and fruit. So you had like three types of fruit or vegetable to grow. So what sort of fruit would you like to eat? Anyone?
Bananas.
Fruit? Bananas, okay. So bananas for sure. What about a vegetable? Spinach and another veggie?
Yeah.
Carrots, okay. So this is one way you could do it, right? I'm going to grow my carrots. When I've got my carrots, I'll harvest them, and then I'll put in my spinach. And when that's ready, I'll take out my spinach. Now I'll put in my
banana
tree. Yeah? And I'll grow up the bananas, and I'll get them, and I'll just decide like that. Yeah? That's one way you could do it, isn't it? What's another way?
You grow them all at once.
Just grow them all at once, right? And help yourself. So that's how we do it now, Lineage. You've got all these different ways, but you know, otherwise it's going to take a real long time to get any realization, right? Just like it'll take a long time to get a decent feed. You got one thing at a time.
That's a pretty good analogy, because you plant them all at the same time, but they'll be ripe for harvest
at different times. Oh. That's right.
So,
and
yeah,
you can put it when you eat one. Yeah, so that's why this is how our way of doing it. In fact, many of the other lineages do it this way too. So many times you're in here like just talking like I am, just giving you a general idea. When it comes to practice, it's a little different. You'll still use all those ideas, but how you use them may be quite different, often is. You know, so many times, I say, don't just do it as an ordinary person. Do the emptiness meditation and arise as the deity. Then you do it. So you integrate the tantra with the sutra. Otherwise, like I said, it takes a real, real long time. If you want to go through all the sutras and then start doing tantra, you'd be a very old person. You might not even start it. Now, as a way of sort of summarizing these teachings, the way we do it here, which this here has aspects of sutra and tantra, and it's one of the verses from one of the practices I do. So he says that. So he can see, from my sublime teachers and the three rare sublime ones, I take the safe direction. So what's that about? Refuge. Good idea. That's refuge, right? Sutra. But it's also embodied in tantra. Now, then he says, with myself as clear as the deity, he switched over to tantra. Yeah? Holding a vajra and bell, I present you with offerings. Upholding the teachings of sutra and tantra, I restrain myself from a wide array of faulty deeds. Amassing within all constructive measures, I fully benefit wandering beings with the four types of giving. Now that is a massive summary of all the sutra and tantric practices, and it comes out of what we call the Yeah, so, but in this here, like everything is condensed into this verse, which is why I particularly like it. This sums up succession guru yoga. So you say this six times or three times, done. Everything is in it. And you know, if you can look at the text it can be quite long, right? But everything can be pulled right down just into this one thing, and you can actually practice it from the side. You can say, okay, I take refuge. Now I know about emptiness. Now I appear as the deity. How do I look? Well, I've got a vajra and a bell in my hands like this. You know, what am I doing? Well, I'm making offerings. Out come all the light of all the offerings. Well, folks, okay, I'm going to go quick. A couple of meditation, folks. So please, again, just get comfortable. So you're sitting comfortably, the body is breathing itself. So just imagine that around you are all the great masters of all these lineages you've heard of. And you recognize that each tradition offers unique teachings. Although the teachings are unique, every tradition emphasizes purification of wrongdoing, to gather as much positive potential as you possibly can, and to cultivate wisdom. So when we open ourselves to these teachings, this is what we're trying to do. to cultivate compassion, wisdom, and the skillful means to navigate the path and help others. We began with the Sakya tradition, its path and fruit. Can you recollect anything about that tradition? Perhaps you can recollect parting from the four attachments. And the attachments are to this life, to the cycle of confused existence, the self-interest and grasping. Now the Kagyu lineage, they emphasize direct experience and meditation. Now what do they encourage us to do? I encourage us to let go of past concerns, future concerns, and present concerns. Whereas this school, or the Galupa school, provides a systematic approach to study and practice. Here we integrate the sutra and tantric teachings. Now, every tradition shares the core principle of cultivating self-awareness and regulating thoughts and perceptions. So whatever tradition you're interested in, try to carry the wisdom of it throughout your life. Cultivate your awareness and compassion as much as possible. That way you can bring a sense of clarity and purpose to your life. And now again, breathing in through your nostrils, exhale. So here we're over time, aren't we? But we're going to finish up very shortly. We're just going to finish this last bit off with us, this place here. So Lakmi Tangpa Center is based around these teachers here. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche, who passed away very recently, and Lama Yeshe, who's also no longer with us in bodily form. If you want to read about these great teachers, there's a great book called Big Love, and that'll tell you the whole history of these guys and how this all these centers come about around the world. For us, this is like this a brief history. So in 1974, Lama Zopa Lama Yeshe arrived in Australia, and they had the first retreats here, and Chen Rizik Institute was formed. And in 1982, our Lama Tangpa Center was formed. It was called Chen Rizik City Center, and it was in Newmarket. It was run by Miffy's mother. Then in 1984, Lama Yeshe passes away. But in 1990, Geshe Tashi Tsering arrived. So he taught at our center for like 19 years, if you remember that. Then in 1997, Miffy's mother passed away and she inherited the center. And then like I met her, we got into a relationship together and we ended up here. And so we came in 2007. So that's what, 19 years now. Is it 26? Time's just flown by. Then I think in 2020, not too long ago, we got everything up online. So here's this little picture of when this place we got it. So here's myself with my leopard skin hat and so forth. Standing next to it was Christina, our treasurer. There was Bruce Modley, he was our director at the time. And there's Miffy, our spiritual coordinator. And that's Geshe Tashi Tsering standing there in the middle. And of course, that's out the front there. Up the front here, this is what it looked like, one of those pictures up the top there, right? None of this was here. We just had a table and then we put some things on it, try to make it look as nice as possible. And we had this old throne. I think we brought a throne over with us and it was put here. Of course, everything's changed massively since then. As you can see, this bottom picture, you walk in here, it was just like that. There's quite a few renovations that have been done around the place, and I think it's just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly because of all our volunteers that are here. So I know you're brand new here. I hope you get something out of it. And, you know, it's just, I'll just sort of give a little bit of history thing first. About the third lesson and sort of get into it. But just let you know. So what's our takeaway here? So you know something about early Buddhism and something about it in Tibet and, of course, our centre. So let's wrap up by dedicating... Oh, let's have a look here. So if you are interested in the history and so forth, we've got plenty of material in the library here, and you'll find plenty in any other public library or online. Now, if you do have this practice called Foundation of All Good Qualities anywhere, I would like you to try to start on the first verse and try to memorize it. So you have about 7 days to memorize 4 lines. That's all it is. The foundation of all good qualities is the perfect and kind guru, the perfect teacher. Where is it?
Sorry, the children's
fault, didn't I? Whoa! The most of all is the kind of guru. Correct emotion, then it's the root of the path by clearly seeing this and blah, blah, blah. Right. And you'll get it. But they're in these books, and it's quite a common prayer.
Gosh, yeah. Where have I been? Under a rock, haven't I? Under a rock.
Next week, we're going to talk about these, how it always begins. So it's like how to listen to the teachings and how we should think of ourselves when we come to Dharma centers. And of course, then we'll talk about the life of the Buddha in these 12 deeds. So let's take what we've, the energy we've expended to sit here and listen to this teaching and direct it toward the original goal we set for ourselves. So join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Dual Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. This is a prayer for His Holiness the Dalai Lama's long life. The wish granting, wish fulfilling dual, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind King and Gatsa, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, the prayer for the quick discovery and return of Buddha Shakyamuni. In holding and spreading the moon's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, noble Guru, to you, I make this request.